Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, over the years, we've had a number of shows on different aspects of water. The Florida aquifers and floods and drought around the country, the effects of water quality on reefs and other things, but I've never read a book quite like the one this week's guest has written. His name is Tristan Gooley. He's a British naturalist who describes himself as a natural navigation expert. And he's joining us today from West Sussex in England. The book is called How to Read Water, Clues and Patterns from Puddles to the Sea. And it's a remarkable tour de force, really, on the many forms that water takes and how closely observing those forms and patterns can teach us a great deal about our surroundings. Welcome, Tristan.
Thanks a lot, Cole.
Nice to have you on. I see your previous books are titled The Natural Navigator, and then How to Connect with Nature, and The Walker's Guide to Outdoor Clues and Signs. So they're all kind of connected that way, but this is a term I've never heard before. What's a natural navigator? I don't think it refers to just sailing or finding your way around by looking at the stars. What's involved?
Well, natural navigation is a beautiful art. It's the art of finding your way using your surroundings, using nature. So absolutely anything is fair game from my perspective. Sun, moon, stars, wind, weather, plants, animals, buildings, even the way people move. I take the view everything outdoors is a clue that can help us find our way. Sometimes it's an easy clue to crack, like the North Star. Sometimes it's a tricky one, like a wildflower we might never have seen before. But they can all be helpful if we give them a bit of curiosity.
So it's really kind of a multidimensional view of nature, and it's not just navigation necessarily, but maybe it's using navigation as a pathway into understanding nature better. And the book is 400 pages long. It's really well done. I mean, it's surprising. People contact me all the time and send me books, and I didn't know what to expect here. But this is, quite an interesting book. It includes a huge amount of information and explanations about water and all its guises and locations, from little brooks to the ocean. And I don't know, let's use a few of the stories in it as examples for a way to break into it. I was intrigued by the way that Pacific Islanders navigate from island to island in small boats out in the open ocean. So tell us about that.
Well, that was, it's a good example for me to explain a bit about how I got to write this book, because I love anything in the outdoors that gives us a clue and insight into something else. And for decades, literally, I've been gathering information from different cultures around the world. So the Pacific Islanders, the Arab navigators, the Viking navigators, all of these people had their tremendous body of knowledge, which allowed them pre-instruments, we're not just talking about pre-electronic instruments, but even pre-things like the compass, to find their way across large patches of ocean. But the frustration for me was that these techniques were amazing, and I'll talk about them in a moment, but the frustration was that it's very hard for us to bring them into daily life. And the truth is, if we have to get into an outrigger canoe and go 1,000 miles from land to use something, it's academically interesting, but it's very hard for it to be, day-to-day fascinating. And that to me was the barrier. So if we take the Pacific Islanders, They were totally aware of the very, very close, almost incestuous relationship between the wind and the way water behaves. Now, water's very well behaved. When the wind blows over it, it sets up ripples and then waves, and then these march out across the ocean, and they'll always go in the direction that the wind blows them. But the interesting stuff really happens when these waves bump into something, the something in particular being an island. At this point, waves will do very dependable things. And once we know the patterns to look for, we notice how they reflect off the island. That's probably quite easy for most people to predict, and everybody's seen it on some scale. But they also do slightly less well-known things. They bend round an island in a process known as refraction, and they then bump into each other on the other side, creating beautiful new patterns. And it's these patterns, when felt through a boat, allowed the islanders to know to see land without it being visible, if that makes sense. They could sense land that was well out of visual range, because they would feel the water doing something different. And they knew through many years of experience, what those different rhythms meant. One rhythm means, okay, that's a reflected wave. Another rhythm, oh, we're on the side of the island because this is a bent one. I could go on because there are lots of different parts to these patterns. But this particular example was the catalyst for writing the book, because I noticed these exact patterns in a pond near where I live. It was a real breakthrough moment, because I saw an island. And in my case, it was just a clump of water lilies, but it could be anything. It could be a rock, not much bigger than our hand. You see a breeze pushing some ripples around it, and you spot these patterns. And they are exactly the same ones used by Pacific Islanders for hundreds, if not thousands of years.
Yeah, it's really interference patterns. Anybody who's studied physics understands, or electromagnetic wave propagation understands the way that that waves will wrap around and interact with an object that interferes with them. And so it's the same kind of thing, but it's a bit different looking at it in the laboratory than it is out on a boat in a bumpy sea with wind blowing the waves here and there. And you know, anybody who's been on the ocean kind of understands, okay, here come some waves, but it's different, the level of subtlety that you were describing in your book with which the experienced Polynesian navigators can understand from hundreds of miles away the little tiny ripples and differences in the way that wave directions are coming from can tell them exactly where a small island is 50 miles away, way over the horizon. And that was kind of interesting. And they used a kind of, you know, this is all pre-technology, and I think that's the core of what you do is getting around in the world before technology, right? So you described a thing, I forget the name of it, but it was kind of a something woven out of rattan that was more or less like a chart that they would use to teach this to younger navigators. So describe that a little bit, if you would.
Yes, the Marshall Islands stick chart is it's an object of beauty in itself, but it has great value in us understanding a massive cultural difference. Because if we think of map making and its history in Western cultures, by and large, what happened is people we live mostly on land, and we spend, you know, apart from a very small subset of society, you know, time at sea is not a big part of most people's lives historically and today. And so most cartography focused on detail in the land, and a really detailed map will tell you when the types of trees change. You know, in the UK, we have our Ordnance Survey maps, and you'll have your equivalent there that tell you, okay, you've got deciduous forest here and coniferous forest there. They tell you about the different types of roads, everything down to a stream, contours, all of that detail. But the fascinating thing about the seaborne cultures is that actually, once you're on an island, your need for mapping pretty much disappears, because quite often these islands are so small you can almost see from one end to the other and you're not going to get lost. However, you can easily get lost between the islands. So these stick charts actually gave the next generation navigators an idea of how the water will behave between the islands. So it's really unique.
Yeah, it was. It was a kind of surprising thing. And, you know, again, it's pre-technology, but in their world and in their terms, it was technology, right? Because they're using a device that was constructed to relay a concept to other people. It was pretty interesting. You know, and I'm skipping over all the things where you talk about just basically walking along a stream or a canal near your home and all the things you can see. And there's a lot of that in there. But one chapter in your book tells about your visit to the Middle Eastern nation of Oman to sail in a dhow. That's a D-H-O-W, which is a small coastal sailing vessel used for, I guess, fishing and trade. So what was that like?
Oh, it was a huge privilege. And it's one of the great joys that I've been doing this line of, this rather peculiar line of work for so long now, that these emails and invitations, you know, appear out of nowhere. And I was invited to spend some time on this research vessel off the coast of Oman. Specifically, the invitation was, you know, we want to do something that's historically accurate. And will you come on board and help us navigate by using the sun, moon, stars, and other methods? And I was overjoyed. You know, it took me about a minute to reply. Yes, please. And it's great because all of these trips, I hopefully get to sort of add a bit in terms of navigation knowledge, but I'm always researching as well. And I learned so much there. I learned boat wakes. So my approach is to treat the patterns and clues in the water as almost like a species of animal. So I say to people, once you know how to recognize a boat wake and its different parts, it's just the same as recognizing a duck or a cat. You know, each individual one may be a tiny bit different, but they all share certain characteristics. So that's really my approach, is don't think of these things as, you know, dry, dusty things that stay in the book. These are creatures that, you know, once you get to know them, they become almost like friends, and you can see them every day.
In this latest book, you know, Reading Water, you bring in not just the forms that water takes, but also its effects on the plants and animals and land around it, which is what you're getting at here. And it seems you can take small clues in just standing and looking and tell a great deal about the nature surrounding you, kind of a total immersion. I mean, I think you're a water guru in a way, and you can stand and really just absorb the whole reality of an area by looking at the water. So kind of give us an idea of what that's like.
It's a process that works two ways. If once we accept that every single animal and every single plant on Earth has a need for water, and therefore the likelihood of it being somewhere tells you the likelihood of water nearby, that flows, forgive the pun, the other way as well. When we see water, that will massively influence the likelihood of seeing certain things. So let me give you some practical examples. If you're walking along a path and you suddenly There's a cloud of small flying insects, midge type things, you know, just a cloud in your face. You know, I think it's happened to all of us, you know, more common certain times of year than others. You know, that's not random. That is telling you, depending on the particular insect and the part of the world you're in, it is telling you there's very likely to be a puddle or a pond or still water very, very close by, particularly if it hasn't happened often. You know, in some parts of the world, you know, these insects are everywhere. But if we take it the other way, if we see water, we are much more likely to see certain trees within certain families. So the willow family, you know, all over the world is an indicator of water. So we can see that every single landscape having this two-way indication. If you can't see water, then plants and animals will tell you where it is. And if you can see water, it'll tell you the plants and animals you're likely to see. So it's giving us a kind of map.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with British naturalist and, I guess, natural navigation expert Tristan Gooley about water in particular and all of the things that you can learn by through the connection of water with the rest of nature. Tristan, you run a natural navigation school there in the UK that, I guess, provides courses on the kind of thing we've been talking about. Are these both indoor and outdoor, or how does that work, and what kind of people participate?
Yeah, it's a big surprise to people to know that a lot of the courses I run are run indoors, because the people who come on them are definitely outdoors people. But actually, the more you think about what natural navigation entails, the more you realize that you can learn fast indoors. So let me give you an example. On a one-day indoor course, we will cover sun, moon, stars. You know, that might take up, you know, 2 to 3 hours, depending on the course. You know, the irony is I use very current, very capable software and projection and things like that. I can say to people, this is what sunrise looks like, you know, in this part of the world. This is what it looks like 1,000 miles north. This is what it looks like in December. This is what it looks like in June. This is what the stars will look like if you look north in February. This is what they look like if you look east in September. You get the idea. And using models, you can actually get people up to a level of astronomical, practical astronomical knowledge. I'm not talking about theoretical, as in, right, we need to learn the names of all these constellations. I'm talking about, okay, this constellation is telling you that the North Star is there. The North Star is your indicator of north. This sort of knowledge would have typically been passed on in very gentle dollops for over a period of 10 or 20 years to perhaps an indigenous person, and it goes on to this day. But the people come on my courses are effectively saying, is there any chance we can kind of short circuit the 20-year way? Can we learn this stuff in a day? And you know, to a large extent, the answer is yes.
Well, I realize it's a long commute to school for people here in the U.S. who might want to attend your course, so it's probably not that practical. But are there different levels of courses? And again, what kind of people participate? Are some of the people just total neophytes and some are expert navigators? How does that range?
Yeah, one of the great joys for me is that the subject is a very broad subject. It contains within it, as I've mentioned, astronomy, but botany, geography, geology. Almost every outdoor discipline you can think of has some bearing on natural navigation. And so one of the great joys is that it attracts such a breadth of people. The only thing that everybody who reads my books or comes on my courses has in common is they're looking to add a layer of understanding to their interpretation of the outdoors. So I ran one course many years ago where I had a landscape artist who'd been painting similar landscapes for 20 years. And they ended up sitting next to somebody they hadn't met before, who was a retired, very experienced army officer who'd you know, been in the military for a couple of decades, at the sharp end of things. And both of them had the same motive. They wanted to be able to step outdoors with their huge experience and just have, you know, I'm not going to arrogantly say that in a day I'm going to change entirely the way they see the outdoors, but all they're looking for is just another perspective, another level, another way of, you know, unlocking the secrets around us.
In the U.S., there's a TV series, you may be aware of this, called Fat Guys in the Woods, in which a wilderness survival expert takes the aforementioned urban fat guys out and teaches them to survive. Usually they start out as helpless as babies, and they need his help just to live past the first day and night, I guess. But do you find that most people are pretty clueless about nature nowadays?
Well, I think none of us in evolutionary terms could survive unless we had the ability to do this sort of thing. Yes, we can get out of shape physically and that sort of thing. But actually, in evolutionary terms, we've got all the kit there. It's you know, for most of us, it's rusty in some places. But the probably the key thing for me to say is that there's quite a big difference between, you know, physical survival and understanding things. And I think for most people, there's a huge amount to be gained by understanding what's going on without actually feeling like it's worthless if you don't go and spend two weeks in a wild part of the world. I mean, most of my work is it's the thinking end of this stuff rather than the doing. So, you know, I have huge respect for people who can make a fire using a bow drill and, you know, put together an incredible shelter complete with windows and the rest of it in a few hours and that sort of stuff. Those are truly, you know, extraordinary skills. But my work sits, you know, it sits alongside it. The two things help each other. But my work tends to be, you know, if I look at that plant, you know, what's it telling me? Rather than, you know, I can use that plant to you know, make tinder for a fire. And actually going and making the fire, my work is much more about the deductive side, as in looking at stuff and understanding, you know, what it's trying to tell you. It's a subtle difference, but it's quite key, because there are literally thousands of people out there now who are focusing on the physical skills and many of them doing an extraordinarily good job. But there's a very, very small group of us who are looking at the world and trying to, you know, focus on the clues. You know, that's really the key to my work, is that word clues, I think.
So given the fact that you're kind of like a conceptual expert, then apart from your courses, are you asked to give lectures sometimes and presentations that are more intensive to focused groups of professional navigators or professionals in some way or other?
Yeah, I do a lot of talks all around the world, and I'll be speaking in New York next spring, possibly more broadly as well. We'll see how that pans out. But the audience is spread enormously from, as I think you were asking, you know, I do little bits of work with extreme experts, whether survival or military or naturalists, to you know, what I might describe as the Sunday walker, you know, people who you know, have learned something that they perhaps thought was just a bit out of their reach and they want to learn a bit more. And they're equally rewarding.
Again, we're on American Variety. I'm Court Lewis. We're talking with Tristan Gooley, a natural navigation expert. Tristan's a fellow of the Royal Institute of Navigation and also the Royal Geographical Society, kind of the UK's version of the National Geographic Society here. So he's recognized as an accomplished explorer, and you've undertaken, I know you describe in your books and on your website, a number of personal expeditions. Why don't you tell us about some of those adventures you've been on yourself?
It started probably younger than I could pinpoint, but I was about 10 when I went on a dinghy sailing course. And at the end of this 5-day course, the sailing instructor came to my sailing partner and me and said, "Where would you like to go today?" And I think I realized then that the art of understanding how to get from A to B was quite a beautiful skill, because it meant that people were suddenly saying, "Okay, you can now go where you want to go." And I think, although the word navigation didn't mean anything to me at the time, I realized that, you know, the way I'd put it now is every journey we go on, we are either a passenger or a navigator. And there's nothing wrong with being a passenger. But once you're a navigator, you call not just whether you go from A to B, but whether you go from A to C to D to E, and exactly how you do it. So small boat journeys became bigger ones. And this led to, you know, some big goals. I traveled from the south of England to the highest point in North Africa and back without buying a ticket. You know, that small boat, small planes, you know, climbing up the mountain, and then to flying solo and sailing single-handed across the Atlantic. But all of this really was in pursuit of this art, which I fell in love with steadily my whole youth, which was, you know, the art of navigation.
You said you flew and sailed single-handedly across the Atlantic both?
Yeah, and it's the again, it was really pursuing an expertise in navigation. I wasn't doing it because I thought, wow, this is going to be a whole heap of fun sitting in a small plane above a big ocean, or sitting in a small boat in the middle of it. Of course, there were exciting, fun times, but it was, in a sense, a practical academic pursuit, in the sense that I wanted to get to a point where I really felt that I understood conventional navigation in its fullest sense. And the only way I felt I could do that was to set myself that goal. I could pass as many exams as I wanted, and it probably wouldn't have given me that sense that, okay, now I think I know what conventional navigation looks and feels like. So that was the aim.
I'll toss you a softball question. How many people have done that?
There are only two people who have ever done it: myself and an American called Steve Fossett, who sadly died in a light aircraft crash on the, I think it was on the Nevada-California border. And that's, you know, I never knew Steve personally, although I tried to get in touch with him. But yes, it was one of many signs to me that I was at the edge of what could be considered safe navigation, because he was an extraordinary navigator.
I think it kind of confirmed you as a professional adventurer. You've done something that is pretty much Guinness Record Books kind of level stuff. I think you took some kind of walkabouts, let's call them, with nomadic peoples here and there. What were a couple of those like?
Yeah, again, I went into the Libyan Sahara and walked across 100 miles of that very, very remote, arguably one of the remotest places on Earth, the southwest corner of Libya. And again, I wasn't really doing it for a sense of adventure. I was doing it to understand how these extraordinary Tuareg people found their way. And the same in Borneo. I put together an expedition to get into the heart of Borneo and walked across 40 miles of that with the Dayak people, who again, you know, some of the most highly skilled natural navigators in the world. And it was all about, you know, pulling the leeches off you every sort of 20 minutes is you know, the price you pay for learning something that's a little bit unusual, I guess.
Not a price too many people would be willing to pay, I suspect. So did you, I mean, with the Tuaregs and the Dayaks, did you speak their language even at all?
No, with the Tuareg, it was just me and two Tuareg, and communication was very difficult. In fact, there were four languages, you know, between us. I had no useful level of Arabic. I didn't speak the local, you know, Tuareg dialect at all. They spoke barely one or two words of English. So actually the only language we had to start with was a smattering of French. My French isn't very good, and they didn't profess to be brilliant at it either, but it allowed me to build up a basic dictionary. So I would point to something, or use a French word. They would then give me their common day-to-day words. So for example, I pointed a star and they say Nejem. And so I scribbled it down in my book. And it's amazing how fast you can do it within a couple of days. We weren't struggling for communication.
Yeah.
In Borneo, I worked with an interpreter / fixer. The whole thing would have been very, very difficult without their help. A guy I came to know as Shady he was absolutely brilliant, and you know, not only made the thing physically possible by helping me, you know, with introductions and all the rest of it, but actually making the communication possible, because French wouldn't have been any use in there, that's for sure.
You're right. Wow. Well, out of all your sometimes extreme experiences, have there been, I mean, what are your most memorable experiences, both good and bad? I mean, have there been some harrowing things where you nearly died, or were there some things that were just absolutely euphoric experiences? You know, tell us just a couple of those.
Yeah, I think the times we've nearly died are probably huge, you know, but we remain ignorant of them. There are times when we become aware that things are getting very serious. And finally, the one experience that I come back to a lot, because it was the feeling that I was about to die, which very quickly became comical. I was descending down towards Scotland in this single engine aircraft called a Cessna Caravan. And I was starting to feel a bit jubilant, because I pretty much crossed the Atlantic by that point. And I think, okay, this is all. And then suddenly, above the roar of the engine, bear in mind, this is not like a sort of a civilian airliner type thing. You know, you've got the roar, it's like a giant lawnmower. You've got your headset on to protect your ears, and so you can hear the radios. You've got the six-point harness, all of this stuff going. There's this massive noise around. On top of that, I started to hear this terrifying creaking sound, like the aircraft was breaking up. And I was thinking, oh no, what's happened? Have I pushed it? I had to go up very high because I was hitting conditions called icing, and then I had an oxygen mask, and all these things were going on. And as I descended, just as I was suddenly thinking, okay, we've cracked this, it started to sound like the aircraft itself was cracking up. I thought, what have I done wrong? And then I was looking all around, expecting to see these cracks appearing in the aircraft around me. Mm. And it turned out that all it was that I had around about a 2-liter empty soft drink bottle at the start of the flight between my legs, because you know, relieving yourself is not easy. I was in an immersion suit, very hard to get in and out of, and this you know, big clunky harness and everything. Anyway, long story cut short, I'd over the course of the flight, I'd half filled this bottle pretty much. I certainly felt like it anyway. But the air in there when I'd done it was you know, perhaps 17,000 or 18,000 feet, you know, quite thin air.
Mm.
There's no pressurization in these aircraft, or certainly not the one I was in. And so as I descended into Scotland, the bottle was done up so the yellow stuff wouldn't go running everywhere. So the bottle just started compressing, and it made this dreadful sound.
Yeah.
But I went from thinking, okay, the aircraft's about to break up around me and I'm going to die, to thinking, well, the worst that's going to happen is this cockpit's going to start stinking and I'm going to get wet feet, which was fine by me.
The bottle's going to break. You were worrying me for a second. I thought we were going to get more information than we really needed. But anyway, all's well that ends well, so to speak. Well, I had, as I said at the beginning, I'd never heard of natural navigation. It's an easy concept to get your head around once you hear about it. But it does seem to me that maybe, at least in the UK, you've managed to get natural navigation recognized now as a legitimate pursuit, let's call it, as a field. But I suspect that you were often seen as pretty eccentric when you were starting out. Is that a true characterization?
Yeah, I probably am seen as pretty eccentric still. I think anybody who works in an industry which has a full-time professional list of one person is pretty eccentric. But you're absolutely right there on a serious note. Because I'd done this conventional navigation, I knew how to fly a plane, I knew how to sail a boat, I knew how to get people up and down mountains safely. When I then said there's another way of doing it, people like the Royal Institute of Navigation and the Royal Geographical Society, they didn't laugh it out of court. And I see this happen with other people. You know, if somebody's come from left field and been on left field their whole life and they then propose a different way of doing things, the establishment or whatever you want to call it can be a little bit, you know, resistant, not always rightly. So it definitely helped in that sense. People couldn't say, well, he's only doing it this way because he can't do it the way we suggest, because I'd done it the way they suggested. And then I was saying, let's try something else.
All right, so we just have a minute or so left, Tristan, but if you can do this in a nutshell, a philosophical question for you. Most people, I think, won't find themselves needing to survive in the wilderness, right? That's obvious. But what, in your mind, is the ultimate purpose or benefit of learning to read water for the average person?
Well, I see the ability to read water as adding a bit of interest every single day, because it's quite hard to go a whole day without seeing a bit of water, because we tend to be where the water is. And getting to know these clues and patterns in the water is the beginning of a sense of there's nothing random out there. Absolutely everything we see is trying to say something to us. I sometimes people joke with me, the puddle whisperer. And that's really what I'm saying is you look at a puddle and you know that there are, for example, more puddles on the south side of a track, or puddles tell you where animals or people have been turning, then those puddles which around us all our lives are suddenly talking to you. And the same is true of rivers, lakes, seas, all of these things. And that is the start of a very exciting journey.
Interesting. Well, I'll tell you, to me, if fellow Brit Bear Grylls, which I guess we've all heard of, can make a go of it with his wilderness survival TV shows, maybe you could too with this kind of thing. Have you ever thought about doing that kind of show, just very briefly?
I've done little bits of TV in the UK, but I put so much effort into making my books as good as they can that I don't actually give a lot of thought to anything else. You know, sometimes I'm lucky. The phone goes and says, "Do you want to do this fun different stuff?" And I generally say yes, but I'm nicely busy.
Well, that's good. Good to know. And so again, for those who might want to get busy getting some of Tristan's books, you can learn more about Tristan at www.naturalnavigator.com. And I think the best place in the U.S. to get his books is probably Amazon, where Tristan has his own page on Amazon. Just type in Tristan Gooley. That's G-O-O-L-E-Y. Well, Tristan Gooley, gosh, it's been interesting and unusual, and I really enjoyed talking with you. Thanks a lot for being on with us on American Variety.
Thanks a lot for having me, Cole. It's been fun.
Yep. And thanks to all of you out there for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.